You're listening to episode 144 of the Rebel Buddhist Podcast, where we talk about the East aspect of your wild mind and why we like to escape and evade.
Welcome to the Rebel Buddhist Podcast, where we explore how to use the science of psychology, Eastern spiritual practices like mindfulness and compassion, and the game-changing work of self-coaching so you can free your mind and free your life. I'm your host, Anna Verzoni.
Hey, hey, humans. Kamusta? That's how are you in Tagalog? I'm recording this in the Philippines, where I flew specifically to hike into the mountains and receive a traditional tattoo from Apo Wang Od, also known as the last Mambatpatok, the traditional Kalinga tattooist, who actually has trained her grandnieces as well. Anyway, I'm really excited as this was more of a pilgrimage for me. And I was able to receive her signature and then also a Bisayan tattoo design from her grandniece, Grace. And some other friends I was with received this as well. I had a good buddy join me on this adventure from Hawaii. And we were also blessed because she ended up not doing any the next day and hiked her 105-year-old self out of the village on a steep trail to go to a festival. She's amazing. So I fly back to the U.S. tomorrow and wanted to get this out to you before I did, because we are diving into the East this week. I know a lot of people in my orbit know the sub-personalities of the East well, the escapists, the addicts, the bliss heads, and the kids that never grow up, like Peter Pan syndrome or Wendy syndrome. And I certainly do. Like, I for sure have some of this in me, because with these imbalances, we like to escape or evade. And this might be with adrenaline activity, running into the woods away from civilization, using substances, shopping, internet surfing, personal growth work, like spiritual practices to take us up and out of this clusterfuck we often see happening on Earth. But before we dive into all the ways we try to avoid dealing with our shit, let's see what's possible when East is well cultivated, because that'll give us some perspective as to why it might just be worth it to cut back or completely eliminate some of these behaviors. Might give us a sense of hope, right? So for those of you new to this four-part series, this is part 3 out of 4 of learning some basics about our wild mind based on the book by Bill Plotkin by the same name. We're diving into the East, and we covered the North and the South in the previous 2 episodes. But don't worry, you can still just drop in right here, right now. You don't need the other 2 right now. So the East, the cultivated East, contains elements of the innocent and the wise element of us, the sage. So we have this paradox where we can simultaneously be innocent and wise, right? It's also the archetypes of the sacred fool and the trickster. Like we're thinking the sort of coyote archetype, the playful trickster energy, this wise and playfully innocent, right? The sacred fool and the trickster, they don't play by the rules or standards of everyday society. And this archetype is present in many cultures, right? We see these archetypes all over the world. And unlike the rebel of the South, these aspects don't care what others think of them, and they're neither for nor against social norms or conventional ways of doing things, whereas the rebel of the South just wants to completely go against whatever's more standard, right? So in terms of like the sacred fool and the trickster, think of people like the 14th Dalai Lama and his friend Archbishop Desmond Tutu, who died the day after Christmas in 2021, actually. Both are known for their deep wisdom and insight and big belly laughs, their innocent capacity to feel joy and be delighted. Think of Pema Chodron, our capacity to transmit deep wisdom and also crack me up, right? And I remember in the Wild Mind book, it's mentioned that some say wisdom is simply innocence seasoned by experience. Yes, this is exactly what we're talking about here in the East. So this paradox exists, innocence and wisdom. And I talk about paradox more in episode 83, so check that out. But it's no joke that it can be hard to hold paradoxical feelings, values, and beliefs sometimes. But paradox exists all around us and within us. When we sit long enough with the paradox, we discover that innocence and deep wisdom actually have a lot in common. Things like purity, virtue, a sense of moral integrity, right? That comes really naturally, like that innocent kind of moral integrity. And the East facet moves us beyond our everyday self-focus to a greater awareness of the whole that we're a part of. So the West facet, in contrast, takes us deeper inside, inviting this understanding of ourselves that's more profound, more meaningful than our everyday social identity. And we'll cover that next week. But the East is wide angle, big picture. West zooms into the specifics of our individual experience, right? And the East is more expansive. So the East is also where the sun rises, where we see the light after the long night. So it's often associated with beginnings, origins, and birth, and with illumination, transcendence, enlightenment, and spirit is associated with the East and soul with the West. So you might think this like, oh, well, just some people have this quality of the East or these capacities. Like, oh, that's not me. I'm not playful or remotely innocent or remotely wise. But it is possible that we all have a facet of our psyches that is both innocent and wise, both joyous and serene, both goofy and insightful. And that can help us lighten up and live beyond conventional rules and norms, right? So is this possible? Fuck yeah, it is, right? Because think about times you've had the capacity to laugh at how ridiculous you can be. Like when you can laugh about how serious you might be all the time, like the time you lost your shit because something didn't come in the mail or got stressed out of your mind about a paper or presentation that was due or blew up at your partner because they walked too loudly in the house or something ridiculous like that. Like, you know, you've accessed your ease whenever it feels like that lightness steps in. And you might have also noticed it when it feels like this dark veil has been lifted and you can actually see something all of a sudden with so much clarity. It's almost like, how did I not see this sooner? Like one of my clients described it like when she cultivated this capacity to shift her perspective to one that better served her, she said it was like, oh, I finally took off shit-colored glasses. It was right there the whole time. And now I can see it so clearly, right? And for sure, the East facet is full on. The last time you were really spontaneous or impulsive, or when you were able to lighten up a tense social situation with just the right well-placed comment, right? Or if you ever took a risk, artistic risk, professional risk, social risk, even though you knew it might be embarrassing, or maybe even because you knew it might be embarrassing. So the East, and like if we're just going to make it succinct, the East helps us lighten the fuck up in the midst of all of this, right? We can tap into the joy of living simply and spontaneously. And without it, without the East, we get heavy, dark, stress-filled, and it seems like nothing can make us laugh. But it's in there, in us. Even if for you like me, it seems very far away at times. You know, this reminds me of when I was at a conference at UCSF. This was when I was an ER nurse practitioner and I was listening to a cardiologist. Actually, he was like a cardiothoracic surgeon. And he was giving a talk and he was saying how his patients who are classical type A, because y'all know the story of how type A was discovered. It was this cardiologist. And he noticed his chairs needed upholstering more than others because his patients were so stressed out. They were like clawing at the armrests and stuff. So this cardiologist said he would ask his patients, if you had an hour, what would you do for fun? And people could come up with bigger trips like, oh, I would go on vacation to Bali or something. Or if they had a private jet, they would fly to Paris for the weekend. But an hour? Like they didn't know what they'd do for fun. It was like they'd forgotten how to just chillax unless they had a complete shift in their environment. But if you ask a kid this, like, hey, you have an hour, what do you want to do? I mean, they'd be like, shit, like I have so many ideas. You know, my kid would play. Someday she might just want to watch TV, but usually she'd want to play. She'd head to the beach or the pool if we're in Hawaii, hit the trampoline in Alaska or wrestle with her dad or something, right? What would you do if you had an hour for joy? Not reading or diving into a self-help workshop, like for joy, like a smile comes onto your face and it feels playful. Because I have a tendency to be so serious sometimes, like deep thinking, soulful thinking, contemplating. And I often feel like I have this self-concept that I don't know how to play because my idea of play doesn't look like others. Like, I don't like games or toys, but my version of play is like singing, like sitting around a campfire with someone playing guitar or karaoke with my Filipino family. Like I'm fixing to do tonight after I record this, maybe videoke, right? Dancing. I love dancing. It's the one thing that can keep me up late if I'm sober. I love kitchen dance parties, love dancing with my masterminders, love dancing under the stars at a hot spring on the east side of the Sierra. These days, I love drawing and painting. I love storytelling, making people laugh, hiking somewhere beautiful. So an hour, what would you do if you have an hour? What's that playful part of you, your way of playing, that you would tap into? Now, what about love in the East? Remember how in the North, love is expressed as protection. With South, it's more of a carnal love. In East, it's a spiritual love, and it can dissolve our defenses so we can expose our core. We're more vulnerable. We can be truly seen. We can see others, and it embraces our deepest human nature. It can take us out of our small everyday story. And we celebrate this bigger than us perspective, a big picture perspective, like as far out as the cosmos with the East. So not just transcendent, like Zen garden spiritual, right? It can also have that trickster vibe, like the Zen master will whack you with a stick to wake the fuck up while you're falling asleep meditating, right? It's also the spiritual love between people, this capacity to love unconditionally and generously. And the other thing about the East is this quality of innocence, which a lot of us think is lost at some point or another, but it's actually still present in each of us. Despite all the shit we've been through, all the suffering, all the trauma, we can still access that quality of innocence. And we can still access that capacity to be present with wonder. Like when you pull around the corner after that tunnel in Yosemite and you see the valley in front of you, it's like, I never get sick of that. Or a sunset. One thing I love about Hawaii, where I live there, I see the sunset every night. And I get to witness other humans pausing at the end of their day, pauhana, as it's said in Hawaiian, and they take in the wonder of the sunset. And for these few moments, we can let go of all the socialized and colonized bullshit for however brief bit of time that might be. And this innocence also requires presence, right? Not ruminating about the past, not worrying about the future, but complete presence and groundedness. And another aspect of the East also believes, and this is big for me, that the world will take care of us. Right? So no wonder it's so hard for me to play sometimes, I think, because as a kiddo, I had to do so much on my own. And I just figured like, oh, that's how it always needed to be. And like, there isn't someone watching my back. I got to make sure I'm keeping an eye out for this, right? So we actually within us have this belief of a well-nurtured kid that the world takes care of us. Because when we remove all that trauma and the ways it's affected our perceptions, you know, we are taken care of on so many levels. And when the East is well cultivated, we can see that and we're in touch with that. And the East qualities are really similar to the beginner's mind of Buddhism, this fresh eyes, open heart, curiosity, trust, opening to the world before us. So yeah, we can outgrow the ignorance of how the world works, but we can also keep innocence alive at the same time. And with this bigger picture perspective comes wisdom, right? Now, to clarify, wisdom is different from knowledge. Knowledge is knowing facts, and wisdom is about understanding, realization, and it comes with discernment. So wisdom allows us to let go of the less important things in our lives and to ask ourselves, what the hell do we really want? What really matters here? Lao Tzu said, the way to do is to be. And you've heard me rant about that for a few episodes, right? This is action rooted in being. Another paradox, how East, right? We see this all the time in the East. So what about the East when it's not fully cultivated? And, you know, also known as our inner protectors, are our sub-personality or subs. That's another way of saying it. They're constellations of feelings, images, and behaviors that more or less work independently from one another and often independent of our conscious awareness and our conscious selves, our egos. And as a reminder, these subs form in childhood, and they have the purpose of protecting us from physical, psychological, and social harm. And they're often really good at that. But the unintended consequence is this can create a bunch of other problems for others as well as ourselves. So like when we think of how in Western psychology, we have psychological symptoms and illnesses, it would be the subs that are the source of this or the catalyst of this, right? So in the past episodes, we talked about the victim, the rebel, the critic, the tyrant, the addict. They all attempt to protect us from more suffering by using our childhood survival strategies. So in the East, this is generally some form of escaping or evading reality. Escaping or evading reality. That's what we do in the East when it's not well cultivated. So the escapists try to check out, right? After all day at a job we hate, we might spend hours playing video games or binge watching TV. The addict, you know, maybe we suffer a deep loss, a parent, a child, a lover, and we start over drinking, overeating, watching too much porn to buffer away the pain. The bliss head, like good vibes only, that new agey shit, like with crystals and sound baths, while intentionally ignoring world events and systemic oppression, right? Like spiritual bypassing. And you might wonder, like, well, what's wrong with that? Right? What's wrong with wanting to feel good? And nothing's wrong with ecstasy, like authentic ecstasy though, right? Authentic, because as long as it doesn't keep us from intimacy, authenticity, personal development, our full participation in the world. And this is exactly what we sacrifice when we rely on the blisshead sub, right? To evade the painful or risky emotions or realities of our lives. So the poor, this is another archetype. I don't fucking know if I'm pronouncing that right, but there you go. That's my version this episode. So the poor is checking out by having fun, right? Peter Pan syndrome, Wendy syndrome. They often love sports. They're often really good at the sports. They love soaring above mundane world responsibilities, relationship tensions, and commitments. Maybe they're in like, I don't know, paraglider, right? Just kidding, but not really. But really having, like these folks that have to ski, climb, ride, to not just get exercise and, you know, do our normal, like, I feel good, you know, good mental health, getting out in the sun type of thing, but having to do it because it removes them from realities. The religious scholar, Robert Siegel, he said, the poor commits to nothing, so he risks nothing. Exactly. It's like the opposite, if we're looking at archetypes here, this is the opposite of a hero or heroine in traditional myths. So the subs of the East evade. They avoid difficult emotions and memories and circumstances and responsibilities. And socially, this might look like the folks that just disappear at a party without saying goodbye, or someone you just all of a sudden you don't hear from them for a long time, or people that just ghost you and you're like, what the fuck? Where are they? Where'd they go? Or being late all the time, reckless behavior, acting flighty or flippant, right? Early in life, this was helpful because it protected us from overwhelming emotions, maybe even pain, maybe even physical pain, right? Later, the subs try to shelter us from more existential dangers, like discovering we're not leading a meaningful life. Or they want to keep us from heeding the call to adventure and the descent to soul. And I see this in my practice. Like some people, you know, during an altered stage journey, they'll say, oh, I want to fly, right? In terms of their internal journey. But often, like, flying, going upward, transcending, that's not what's needed. Often on this path, we need to go down, 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 down. So the East subs can be so helpful because, like, they block our awareness or memory of a trauma, right? Which can be helpful until it's not. And interestingly, the cardinal direction where we feel most at home tends to be the opposite on the cardinal directions of our least developed facets. So people that feel really at home in the East tend to have an underdeveloped West. And it's challenging for them to balance it with the understanding and even like pleasure that going into the darkness and the subterranean that we can find in the West, right? So in the East, just wants to escape into the light. And often the escaping parts of us can physically remove us from social scenes that we think are dangerous or really uncomfortable. But if that doesn't work, or if it's not possible, they protect our psyches by removing us experientially, right? By preventing us from remembering or even registering or fully feeling a traumatic event. Maybe they let us witness the events themselves, but then we're buffering and numbing out, and they prevent us from fully experiencing the challenging emotions brought on by those events. Or they might have completely separated our consciousness from the events, like in dissociation, to prevent or delay our awareness, our knowing of a trauma, right? And I hear clients saying things like, I left my body while it was happening. This was helpful at the time. It was necessary. Nothing wrong with that at the time. It's when the war is over, the childhood survival war is over, and we're continuing the strategies. Yeah. So sometimes our escapists got really good at fantasizing, right? So good that it felt like we were somewhere other than where we actually were, right? Like dissociating. And we can see this in another way, in people who get lost in these fantasy worlds of AI or in gaming. And so, you know, it'd be helpful to ask ourselves, so when does the East tend to show up? Like, when do I want to sort of ask myself, could this be the East going on? And for sure, the East arises with uncomfortable emotions like grief, hurt, anger, guilt, fear, or shame that's so intense that we feel like we can't endure it. Maybe a betrayal by a friend or a family member, or perceived betrayal even, right? Or the burden of too many responsibilities, or the threat of failure, of humiliation, of reprimand, right? On the one hand. And then on the other hand, fear of too much success or visibility or praise. So through these tactics, they helped us survive, right? And some of us develop this ability to dodge really uncomfortable situations. And if we're avoiding real harm, that could be the nurturing generative adult of the North that we talked about 2 weeks ago. But if we're avoiding a socially risky but potentially growth-enhancing experience, this is more the escapist at work. So if we're avoiding an abuser, that's the nurturing adult of our North. If we're avoiding the risk of being turned down by an employer that we want to work with by avoiding the interview, that's the escapist. Now, about addictions, you know, overdrinking, overeating, overspending, maybe, you know, no official diagnosis, but these are our behaviors. And then even the straight up physical addictions that we might develop, they can remove us from the experience of intolerable pain, like physical, emotional, or spiritual, right? And addictions also tend to generate some form of joy, of bliss, right? And the reality is maybe a much needed sense of calmness or peace, or a fuller sense of belonging or capacity to be present. I remember when I was at Burning Man, there was a great talk by Dr. Carl Hart, who wrote the book Drug Use for Grownups. And he was talking about psychedelic exceptionalism, how, you know, it's mostly white people that use psychedelics, and then it's considered this, like, you know, well, this drug's okay, but heaven forbid, like, people do heroin or something. And he said, look, man, like, so much of this is we are all just trying to feel better. Like, it's hard to be human. And that's all that we're trying to do. Like when people are doing drugs. Like, let's get over this kind of exceptionalism of some drugs are better than others. Like, it's all for the same reason. So we all want to avoid suffering, and we seek pleasure, avoid pain, and do what's easy, right? That's the motivational triad. So most addictions do both, right? They give us relief from pain as well as access to feelings like ecstasy, at least temporarily. And the question that still lingers there is, what is the price we pay for that temporary false pleasure? For example, like an addiction to alcohol, not surprisingly also called spirits, right, can be a substitute for cultivating a relationship with spirit. When people escape into the military, not values driven, but escaping into the military or joining gangs or cults, this can serve as a life or death substitute for the death rebirth process in true, authentic adult initiation. And compulsive eating can stand in for satisfying genuine spiritual hunger. Obsessive gambling, maybe this is like, well, it's better than nothing. It's a better alternative than risking everything to lead a meaningful and fulfilling life. And I'd say on the Adventure Mastermind, this is often something that comes up. Like when we realize that what we actually, like, we realize what we're actually risking if we devote ourselves to a more authentic life. Because for most of us, we risk everything, right? We risk current relationships, current jobs, current lifestyle, all of it. That's often what we have to face when we come face to face with what our authentic life is meant to be, right? So we risk everything, even if that everything we currently have is a more diluted version of what's possible. Should we step into our authentic selves? It's still scary as fuck to lose it or to think about losing it, right? So like we can deceive ourselves into believing that, oh, I'm just doing this to get high, or yeah, I just, you know, this is like a heroic adventure, or I just want to fulfill and like meet my hunger pangs. Like I'm just hungry. Or I just want to accumulate wealth, you know, but at some hidden depth of our psyche, we really want to become fully human. We want to belong. We want to participate unconditionally in the world and to offer our unique gifts to our people, right? Rumi calls it a passion, a longing pain. It's something that we all long for, but we're really afraid of. We yearn for an expansion of consciousness, but we're fucking terrified of the obliteration, the death of our small sense of self as we know it. And we want to transcend the small self, but we're afraid of ruining it or losing it forever. So the cardinal direction of the East is where the sun rises. So the East is universally associated with light, ascension, joy, rising above, transcending. And this suggests what the East sub-personalities and the well-cultivated facet of the East also have in common. Both are oriented towards the light, toward, for example, ecstasy, joy, the divine, and with rising above the mundane, everyday preoccupations with rules, norms, practical shit we have on our to-do list, right? But where the East facet of the self rises towards innocence, present-centeredness, wisdom, the East sub-personality settles for just getting high or spiritually bypassing. While the East self proactively reaches towards illumination and enlightenment, the East sub reactively just flies above difficult or uncomfortable emotions, relationships, responsibilities, realities, right? The East self transcends and the East sub escapes. Are you starting to sense the difference? The East self helps us see the bigger picture. The East subs just want a different picture, any different, and preferably one that feels good, even if falsely good, happier, powerful, or at least safe, safer, right? The East self enables us to expand perception and understanding, while the East sub wants to alter, limit, or distort perception and understanding. And the East self possesses a more mature and healthy sense of humor about the human condition, But the E-subs have a more immature, like flippant kind of attitude towards the human condition and don't acknowledge the darkness, the fear, the grief. Like when people say, wow, Buddhism seems so depressing with the noble truths focused around suffering, but it's actually a mature perspective of reality that allows us to embrace instead of fight it. So sooner or later, we have to address the collective dependence or addiction on the worldview and lifestyle of modern industrialized society itself and racialized capitalism that many, but certainly not all, people share. The modern industrial worldview and racialized capitalism says, in essence, that technological progress is the highest value and that we were born to consume, to endlessly use and discard natural resources, other species, techno gadgets, toys, and often other people, especially if they're poor or from the global south or not white, right? And as Bill says, it's a world of commodities, not entities. Of consumers, not human beings. And economic expansion is the primary measure of progress. Profits over people, money over meaning, national entitlement over global peace and justice, us over them. And this addiction to modern industrialized society, especially now that many powerful countries, even outside of the global West, are also hooked, right? It's by far the most dangerous one because of how rapidly and extensively it's undermining all the natural systems of Earth and the beings on Earth. And addiction to modern industrialized society protects us from seeing and feeling the suffering of Earth and its beings for our habit of buying and consuming and owning. And this addiction also protects us, just like the other subs and addictions. It protects us from having to make any radical changes in how we live our life, or from having to grow up and leave the comfy home of our, you know, symbolically adolescent way of being. And it protects us from heading into the dangerous journey of soul initiation that would lead to an existence that's actually life-enhancing, meaningful, and fulfilling. And the more we live in this imbalanced way, the more we need it to keep us from experiencing the pain of not having a sense of true belonging and purpose. Each of us has the opportunity to carefully examine our lives, uncover the ways in which our addiction to modern industrialized society has us hooked, and tap into our Ziji, that Tibetan word for our radiant inner confidence, to make the biggest, most courageous changes we're able to. Donna Markova writes, "I will not die an unlived life. I will not live in fear of falling or catching fire. I choose to inhabit my days, to allow my living to open me, to make me less afraid, more accessible, to loosen my heart until it becomes a wing, a torch, a promise. I choose to risk my significance, to live so that which came to me as seed goes to the next as blossom, and that which came to me as blossom goes on as fruit." So the descent to soul can get heavy, right? It can get dark, it can get intense, and you want to be sure that when this is happening, right, that you're not going to shut down or close down during those times. That's a form of evasion. That's a closing off to our natural growth. So during a soul journey, that's not the time to analyze what's happening, all the images, the messages, the symbols, the experiences. During a soul journey, we need to be present and absorb what's arising, not hang out in our heads. That's why, like, when I'm with people during their altered stage journey, I'm like, I'll take the notes. Don't worry about writing down notes or writing what's being. Just like raise your hand, talk, I'll write it down for you, right? It's like being present. And the East helps us do that. It lends us a sense of presence and equanimity. So we can stay present no matter what our inner healing wisdom wants to bring to our awareness. After our journeys, when it comes time to embody the soul's messages, we often notice it all feels really overwhelming. The idea of what we need to do and what, in effect, needs to die in order for it to happen. And without a capacity to see the bigger picture, the context of what we're experiencing, all of us as a human being, and without a sense of humor, we're screwed. It's so intense. We have to have this capacity to help us undertake the journey and to come out the other end. And as you've probably been noticing in this series, modern industrialized society encourages us to abandon our authentic self. Our authentic self gets suppressed by family, traditional schools, many religious practices. Like, I remember Maya got the lottery for a charter school and we went to visit it and they were like, "We pride ourselves on discipline and strict attendance, and the kids aren't allowed to talk in the hallways, and they're told to stand with their hands behind their backs and lips zipped." And I was like, "What the fuck? Are we supposed to be stoked about that? No, thank you." But suppressing our authentic selves has to happen to support modern industrialized society, right? Because a human being who's in contact with all the facets of their wild mind and is cultivating them, living into their authentic self, they would be a shitty candidate for the modern social roles of consumer, being a cog in a corporate wheel, a soldier fighting a war based not on values, but on greed and financial gain, which enable military industrialized society to function, right? And this is why we benefit by cultivating the aspects that are suppressed, even though the status quo might not. So what can you do when you have one or more East sub-personality running the show a lot of the time? The main question first has to do with the war of childhood survival. Is it actually over? Because remember, if it's not, now is not the time for this work. Some people are still in that war of abuse, of aggressive oppression, right? This is not the time to apply this. Now, if it is, and we're continuing survival strategies that no longer serve us, then we can ask, do I have adequate access to the resources of my authentic self? These resources we've been talking about in the well-cultivated North, South, East, and next week, the West, right? And do I have sufficient social support, a network, right? And if the answer to these two questions is anything other than a clear yes, it's a good idea to seek help from someone, an organization, a person, a community that has expertise in helping people that are hooked by their escapists or addicts, like people with recovery training, for example, right? Therapists, coaches with training in addiction, addiction counselors, somatic therapists like Hakomi, or somatic awareness therapists trained in recovery work, acupuncture, herbalists, spiritual advisors. And we want to be sure to avoid helpers who are actually rescuers or conformists in disguise, right? Because they're going to just want to tame you with a different substance or an inauthentic way of being. So Bill recommends these 7 steps if the war is over and you have enough support. 1, you recognize that you've been utilizing an addict or escapist strategy and make amends. 2, you abstain from the behaviors that are involved in your addictions and escape patterns. 3, further cultivate resources of all your facets. 4, experience, explore, and heal the emotions, memories, and realities of your addicts and escapists that have been helping you to avoid and learn to respond from the perspective of your whole self instead of reacting. 5, offer your sincere and profound gratitude to your escapists and addicts, right? How have they helped you? The shit worked. We kept doing it for a reason, right? So think of some solid examples and have like genuine gratitude for the work that they did to help protect you. Think about, you know, from the North a couple weeks ago, the loyal soldiers and the gratitude expressed to them for what they've done, right? And 6, replace your old routines with habits that better serve you. So with mindfulness, staying present instead of escaping, getting to know yourself, all parts of you, and learning ways to take more matured action and not just coming from our default childhood strategies, right? And 7, uncover, reclaim, and act on the deep longings beneath our escapes and addictions. Actually do what you need to do to meet those underlying needs. So if you need to, you can go through these steps with a therapist or other trained support person, right? And the order can be flexible, but in general, it goes in that order. And some people are going to need more time with some steps than with others. So just know that going in, right? So in this process and mindfulness of thoughts and actions and feelings, we become aware that we're escaping or evading and recognize it's a coping mechanism and doesn't have to be a part of how we show up. And this is important because now we're conscious of our tendency versus it operating unconsciously. And 12-step programs and others do some of these things, but they tend to lack in cultivating resources. They lack in cultivating the resources of all the facets of ourselves. And maybe that's why people in the Adventure Mastermind often end up buffering less, even if that wasn't their intention for coming in, right? They're cultivating these facets of themselves and their resources. If I ever go back and get another doctorate, I'll probably study something like that. That would be super interesting to me. So, okay. I want to close up here with how do we cultivate these resources of the East? What are some practices, right? One is simply remembering that we have a capacity to be in the calm during the storms, right? We have that ability within us. We all do. We all have the capacity to look how fucking absurd life can be sometimes. We can crack up at how we have this need to control reality and how we need things to be a certain way before we allow ourselves to be happy. We can see the lightness in that. Like me and my friend Jen on this trip, oh my gosh, like we just eventually had to laugh at how really nothing that we planned went the way that we were told it would go or how we thought it would go. But somehow it all worked out. So, but it was like even today we like went in for like our massage appointment and it was like, oh, of course you didn't like schedule it for the right time or for the right service. And it was just like, it becomes comical at a certain point, right? Like how we expect things to go a certain way or need things to go a certain way and then they don't. And when we can crack up about it, that's our East. So we all have that capacity. And we can imagine that we transform, like, you know, a classic thing taught in coaching programs is this, you know, sort of meta view. So we can like, you know, see ourselves as an eagle flying up, taking an eagle eye view or being on the mountaintop looking down so we can see the bigger story that's unfolding below. And from this perspective, we can ask, well, from this perspective, what do I feel now about myself and others in this situation? What are the most important lessons or principles to remember going forward? Can I find the place where I can open to whatever pain is present without having to experience it as suffering? And where in my life do I find joy? So this perspective shift is very East, right? We can also study and practice meditation and being present. No, this is something present all over the world in cultures in some way, shape, or form. And a nature-based form of meditation that's not often taught is just to walk on the land very slowly, just wandering, especially in a wild place, semi-wild place, city park, with all your senses fully open to everything. You're not clinging to or avoiding any experience or encounter. And you have an attitude of loving kindness towards all beings, human or otherwise. So not just walking meditation as traditionally taught, but more of this openness and expansiveness. I feel Thich Nhat Hanh taught this in a way. Whenever I heard him talk about walking meditation, I got this sense. And there are also contemplative prayer, mystical spiritual disciplines like Taoism, Buddhism, Kabbalah, Sufism, yoga. Different contexts might be like an improv class or studying stand-up comedy, right? This helps us to access the archetypes of the sacred fool, the trickster, the innocent, the sage. There's movement-based meditations, Tai Chi, Qigong, to support the cultivation of our East facets, present-centeredness. Right? Trances, like trance dance, trance drumming, practices like five rhythms. And there's always apprenticing to those people who have this facet cultivated naturally and fully. Infants, toddlers, and young children. Like you can spend an hour or a day hanging out with them and let go of the grown-up mindset and just see what happens. How do they play? How do they presence themselves? How do they express their emotions? Laugh, cry, sing, dance, get pissed. Apprenticing to that, right? We can have our morning practice as a praise walk in the morning near sunrise. Walk, take a walk and praise everything that moves you in any way. And dance and sing and chant for that as an offering. Sunrise practice before sunrise when it's still dark. Like dark. Really drop into the present moment and notice how the sun's apparent movement shows us how the earth and us are actually tilting towards the sun as it rises. I love my memories of sunrises at high altitude bivvies on outward bound courses in the Sierra. The magic of waking up in your sleeping bag, witnessing this miracle. Now, the East's primary way of knowing is in being fully present to what our senses are experiencing. The North is knowing, South is feeling, West is imagining, East is full sense experiencing. So the five senses meditation can be a powerful practice as well, right? Noticing what are the sights, sounds, scents, tastes, and bodily sensations available to me right now. And you can open up to more subtle things, not just in your face, wildly colored Kona sunsets like I get to see most nights, but opening to like tiny desert flowers, or the delicate, almost hidden flowers of the tundra, or the feeling of a light breeze on your skin, snowflakes landing and melting on your face, the fleeting scent of a Sitka rosebush as you walk by, or how it smells when your skin touches hot granite after you've dipped in a cold alpine tarn, creosote after a rain. So we can see how this is starting to come together, right? Our nurturing adult of the North that we covered two episodes ago comforts our wounded children when they wake up to the emotions and bodily states associated with our original wounds. Our wild indigenous one of the South from last week reclaims full somatic experience of our emotions and of our connection and belonging with all beings. And yes, even other humans, which I know some of y'all just want to ditch sometimes. And our Eastern aspect of the innocent sage cultivates an expanded awareness of the wounding events in our life and allows us a greater perspective so we can experience a more consciousness shift, right, in that context, and brings an innocent non-attachment to outcome that helps our whole self act in the world in ways our addicts escapists had previously blocked just to keep us safe. Okay. Then next week, when we dive into the West, another favorite of mine, we'll see how our muse beloved intentionally dives for the dark treasures and meanings waiting for us within our wounds, the stuff of soul adventure and inner journeys. Okay, friends? That's it. We're almost done with our four directions. So I'll see you next week.
If you like what you heard, please spread the love and share it. And if you know you need some help with this and want to learn more about how to free your mind and free your life, go to rebelbuddhist.com and grab my free Rebel Buddhist Toolkit, where you'll receive a video training on cultivating resilience, access to the private Rebel Buddhist group where I do weekly live sessions on topics just like this, and a copy of the gorgeous Rebel Buddhist Manifesto, and more for free. That's rebelbuddhist.com.